Remember the story of the thousands of little rubber duckies that fell off a container ship in the Pacific Ocean in 1992, forming an armada of wide-eyed, orange-billed, yellow bath toys? Well, high school English teacher Donovan Hone heard about the ducks when a student wrote an article and went on his own odyssey to find them.
At the outset, I'd never heard of the Great North Pacific Garbage Patch. I liked my job and loved my wife and was inclined to agree with Emerson that travel is a fool's paradise. I just wanted to learn what had really happened, where the toys had drifted and why. I loved the part about containers falling off a ship, the part about the oceanographers tracking the castaways with the help of far-flung beachcombers. I especially loved the part about the rubber duckies crossing the Arctic, going cheerfully, where explorers had gone boldly and disastrously before.
Like Ahab's whale, the ducks would pull Donovan ever deeper into their world. He'd go to a toy fair in Hong Kong, factories in China. He'd ride a container ship, one as big as a Manhattan skyscraper. But unlike Ahab, more like Ishmael, the wandering sailor in Melville's classic, returned to tell the tale of the polluted ocean waters and beaches he also found. His book is Moby Duck, the true story of 28,800 bath toys lost at sea and of the beachcombers, oceanographers, environmentalists, and fools, including the author, who went in search of them. And Donovan Hone joins us from the NPR studios in New York. Welcome.
Glad to be here, Robin.
Let's begin with some common misperceptions. The toys were not rubber. They weren't all ducks. What were they?
They were hollow plastic bath toys, to be precise. They were made out of rigid polyethylene. And you're right, they came in four varieties. There was, in addition to the famous ducks, green frogs, blue turtles, and the one that doesn't really belong, red beavers, totally out of scale with the other ones.
Yeah. Well, and so as fast as you can say, Ishmael, off you go. But first of all, you're not exactly a candidate for this. You're nearsighted. You've got a bad back. And your wife is expecting a child.
Yeah, I was poorly cast for the job of a seafaring adventurer.
You discovered the 6 degrees of freedom.
The six different motions that floating vessels make
Yeah. Is
what they are. Rolling, pitching, yawing, heaving, swaying, and surging.
Yeah. You felt most of them.
I got to experience them firsthand. I thought I could do it with phones and swimming through libraries, as Ishmael says. But then I got an invitation to go beach combing and searching for bath toys on a wild beach in Alaska from one of the oceanographers who'd been studying them, and it was irresistible.
And so off you go, and as you said, you meet a retired oceanographer who studies how various types of garbage moves in the ocean, from Nike sneakers to bodies. Tell us about Curtis Ebbesmeyer.
Yeah, he's a flotsamologist. Well, actually, he's trained as a physical oceanographer and has made a career of it. But he's also managed to study some, publish some scientific studies of flotsam, turning container spills into kind of accidental experiments. There's actually quite a lot that's fallen into the ocean over the years, and that's his expertise.
Well, and from there, as we continue on the journey, Chris Pallister, who started a group that cleans up Gore Point.
That one, I got this phone call from this guy I'd never met in Alaska and had heard that he was trying to clean up this one particular isthmus, Gore Point, that stretches out into the Alaskan coastal currents and filters anything, any flotsam that happens to be passing by. And then over the years accumulated this great kind of accidental landfill of sorts. So it was this big heap of flotsam. He was in the process of trying to get rid of it. And on short notice, I got to accompany him in his very little homemade wooden epoxy boat to hunt for toys.
Well, then this is where we start getting pulled into this netherworld of beachcombers, everybody looking for these toys. Because why? I mean, you know, talisman, it's a fun story to see a little rubber ducky come in on a wave. But what else were people hoping the ducks could tell us?
There are beachcombers who are almost like bird watchers, do it as a kind of a hobby or a sport. But for Ebbesmeyer, the scientific fun of it is that if you can determine where a spill happened at sea, then once beachcombers begin finding toys, you've got a point A and you've got a point B, and you actually can reconstruct their drift routes and learn something about ocean currents.
Right. Well, and for Chris Pallister, who's cleaning up beaches, they tell us about how awful humans are being to our environment. You go with him. It's an incredible cleanup effort. They have bags the size of helium balloons that helicopters are hoisting off these beaches. By the way, describe what it's like when you first saw. I mean, we've all seen debris up on a beach. We're here in New England. You know, we see that right. A lot. But what are you talking about? What kind of debris are you talking about there?
When I arrived, there were cairns, pyramids of debris that had already been bagged. But there was one section of this forest. It's a half-mile-long beach backed by a berm of driftwood logs. And behind the driftwood logs is a beautiful spruce forest. And when you approached this one half-acre of the forest that they had yet to clean up by the time I arrived, you could hear the stuff under the moss as the crunch of plastic bottles. Mm-hmm. And it was in places a yard or more deep. And you'd see an abundance of fishing floats, polyethylene bottles. But if you dug around, you got to find curiosities, sandals. There was a shipload of toddler sandals that went overboard, and those were turning up. There was even a television out there. So that's what it was like.
Yeah, just amazing descriptions. Well, and Chris Pallister and his group sound so well-intended, but you found people who were critical. First of all, when their boats are going out to clean up areas, they're burning fossil fuels. As we said, they collect the garbage, but it just comes back. But also, some people feel that this whole idea of cleaning up beaches is, in a way, greenwashing. He accepts some funding from groups that accept donations from polluters, like the Princess Cruise Lines. But the bigger point is that the sort of the idea of cleanups kind of seems like a mask for the bigger problem, which is regulations that try to prevent it in the first place.
Well, the question is, what are you trying to clean up? Are you trying to clean up an ecosystem? Or are you trying to clean up an idea of the wilderness? And I think in Pallister's case, he was very well-intentioned, though he also, was a bit expedient in his fundraising. I think he genuinely was devoted to the idea that the coastline of maritime Alaska, especially these areas designated as wilderness, should be free of blight. And yet in removing all this debris at great expense and at the cost of boat fuel, et cetera, he doesn't actually necessarily do much for the benefit of the ecosystem in that particular case. That said, there are places near like the habitat of the endangered monk seal, for instance, where removing the debris might actually be a significant benefit to the wildlife there, but not in this particular case.
Yeah, sure. You met environmental lawyer Bob Shavelson, who is one critic of cleanups. He calls the funding from polluters eco-graft and says you have to stop polluting at its source. For instance, despite the Ocean Dumping Reform Act, the U.S. still releases more than 850 billion gallons of untreated sewage every year. In it, Q-tips, dental floss, and tampons. We have such cheery music underscoring this. More with Donovan Hoehn when we come back here and now. Welcome back. We're speaking with Donovan Hoehn, who traveled the world several times over to write the book Moby Duck. It's the story of plastic bath toys, including duckies that fell off a container ship in 1992. Were they really sighted in Maine, in Great Britain? They definitely landed on Alaska's debris-strewn Gore Point. Now, the oceans are so wide, it's impossible to tell how much garbage is in them. But by some estimates, up to 95% of marine debris is plastic. In 1997, 6.4 million tons of garbage fell just from ships alone. A beach cleanup in Los Angeles documents over 84,000 straws, almost 6,000 cigarette lighters, 2,000 toys, and thousands of nurdles. These are those little pieces of resin like you find in a Beanie Baby. Then there is the Great North Pacific Garbage Patch. Donovan Hoehn, we've seen pictures of these huge floating blobs packed with plastics riding the ocean, but you found there's more to them.
The image of the garbage that I first that came to my mind when I heard the phrase garbage patch made me think of something like a floating junkyard. It sounded like out of Jules Verne. Mm. In fact, this is debris that's spread across millions of miles of ocean. Some of it's on the surface, but plastics can be semi-buoyant, so some of it's in the water column. You have to bring a trawl net to find it. And plastic does not biodegrade. Nothing can eat it, or nothing can digest it, I should say. But it does break down in sunlight. So the stuff ends up becoming shards and flakes, hard to see with the naked eye, and eventually into a kind of plastic dust that blows through the water column like dust through air. And so really the best place to see how much is out there is are places like the southern coast of Hawaii on the Big Island, where there's a 9-mile stretch of shoreline that collects just a phenomenal amount of stuff, more than 20 tons a year, one biologist estimated for me.
Right.
Everything that you can think of, from toys to jar lids to fishing nets. And then one beach on that coastline has become nicknamed Plastic Beach because the flotsam has been ground down, so the sand looks like it's made of plastic.
Well, this brings us to the history of plastic, which you do, and remind us that plastic was seen as a godsend. It meant that we didn't have to ransack the earth in pursuit of substances which are constantly growing scarcer. The whale, for instance, back to Moby Dick.
Tortoiseshells, ivory.
Right. And then when we became concerned about plastics in the 60s, we started talking about recycling. But as you say, never mind that only 5% of plastics actually end up getting recycled, that the plastics industry stamps little triangles of chasing arrows into plastics for recycling, even though there's no viable recycling method for many of them. What is the most nefarious about plastic is that it's a perfect material for bathtub toys. So buoyant, so pliant, so colorful, and so polluting. Back to our little ducks and toys on the ocean. Why are they so polluting?
Mainly because plastic persists. People have been trying to make plastics that biodegrade, but really there's not been a commercial application for that technology yet. One of the ones I collected from Gore Point out in the wilderness, a duck, it already had a crack in it from the sunlight and was filling up with water, and I put it in my freezer when I got home and quickly became brittle to the touch. But it will, even as it disintegrates, it chemically can persist for centuries.
But also there's something about how charming they look as they bob along, far more charming than the water bottles that are next to them.
I think what I liked about, part of the reason why I was enchanted by the story was just the incongruity of that image, of these little smiling, insipid symbols of innocence out there on the sublime wilderness of water that was, when Melville wrote about it, divine. That contradiction enchanted me. But then it's true that they mean different things, right? So we can think about them as symbols, but then we can also see that, in fact, they are perfectly designed to last at sea for centuries.
Just there's so many travels. We can't hit on all of them, but at one point you were trying to find the factory where these toys might have been made, and you actually find a mold for a yellow ducky.
Yeah.
What, Holy Grail. What was that like?
You know, I hadn't expected to gain access to the actual factory that had made them. I thought, well, at least I'll go see a toy factory in China. But I had a lucky break, and the owner of the factory agreed to give me a tour. And while I was there, he said, I've got a surprise for you. And he fetched from his archives, because they no longer make these toys, one of the molds that had been used to make the ducks in particular. And I sat down, and I had one of the ducks in my pocket, and I plugged it in. There was something, I felt as if some sort of circle had been closed the moment I did that.
Well, you quote from Melville, as you do throughout the book, the great shroud of the sea rolled on as it rolled 5,000 years ago. This is after the catastrophic voyage of the Pequod in Moby Dick. What are we to learn at the end of Moby Duck?
One of the important things that I'd learned and that I talk about in that passage is that, as beautiful, haunting, and poetical as that sentence of Melville's is, it's really a gorgeous sentence, the oceans have never been immutable or eternal. They've always changed throughout the history for natural reasons, but now they're changing with surprising swiftness, thanks to us.
And what about the ducks? Where are they?
So the most intriguing possibility that these oceanographers presented to me when I got to see their evidence, their maps of where these toys would go, was the idea that at least a small percentage of the toys, computer models suggest, would have slipped through the Aleutian Islands into the Bering Strait and into the Arctic. There we can turn to historical data that we know that shipwrecks and other flotsam in the past, and sometimes messages in bottles or cards dropped by scientists, have actually crossed the Arctic on the transpolar drift. And the idea of that was one of the mysteries that I wanted most to solve, and in some ways the one that took the whole book to solve. Did they make it to that beach in Maine or not? Their trail kind of vanished into the ice. I do have my suspicions, and I did try to answer that question, but maybe I don't want to spoil all of the end.
Right. Well, but they certainly live on in people's imaginations. I mean, as recently as, what was it, 2007? British newspapers reported, they're coming, they're coming in.
And they even found a beachcomber, found a duck, and they put the picture of the duck in the newspaper. And when I saw that, I recognized right away, wrong duck. But most of them didn't bother to run a correction. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's a charming story. It's appeared now in advertisements. And I did, you know, I went to the Arctic to hunt for them. So yeah, but they did vanish into the ice.
Well, and what about you? How have you been changed? You have a son now. You've seen this future that he's inheriting, this plastic-covered ocean.
Yeah.
Thoughts?
You know, I had this idea that I would, partly I was probably just comforting myself, but that I would travel the world and learn things and be able to teach him, impart some curiosity about the places that I would travel, and perhaps a sense of responsibility for the natural world. And I think I've succeeded to some degree to that. I think also my wife and my kids, I have two sons now, are both happy that I've given up my seafaring for the time being. But Bruno, my firstborn, he was telling me at one point that he wanted to go to Antarctica to bring back treasures for his mother and me. So God help him, he may have caught the bug.
That's Donovan Hoehn. His book is Moby Duck, the true story of 28,800 bath toys lost at sea, and of the beachcombers, oceanographers, environmentalists, and fools, including the author, who went in search of them. Donovan, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.